Welcome back to the Bastionland podcast, where we're exploring the rule of three. Each week, I'll talk with a new guest about three tabletop games that are important to them. I'm Chris McDowell, and today I'm joined by a maverick of wargame design. He's conquered the battlefield, the stars, and reinvigorated the second-hand toy car industry. Creator of Gaslands, Billion Suns, and the upcoming Hobgoblin is Mike Hutchinson. Hello, Mike.
Hello there, Chris.
How are you?
I'm really good, actually.
Are you happy with the title that you've reinvigorated the second-hand toy car industry? Because that's certainly how it worked for me. I've ended up with a big box full of old Matchbox cars now to use for Gaslands.
Yeah, no, I'm happy about that. I'm still running scared that Mattel doesn't catch up with me, including pictures of their cars in my rule books. But so far, the crime has gone undetected.
Surely this podcast might be the... I don't want to make this the accidental outing of you. So if any Mattel or Hasbro or any of these big companies are listening, yeah, just...
Actually, funny story. Through work, I got an opportunity to do a collab with Mattel, and I got chatting to one of the techies there. He was like a software developer, and he knew Gaslands, he was excited about it. And he'd been working on the thing with the toy cars that have the chip that you can read in it. And so he started getting excited about, like, oh, there could be a Gaslands app where you scan your Hot Wheels toy car and you get stats from it. And I was like, that sounds cool. And that gave me the idea for the stupid car generator for Gaslands Legacy, if anyone has seen that. Because I was like, wait a minute, I can do this way more easily. And for all cars, even secondhand. So someone in Mattel knows, but it hasn't reached the lawyers.
Right, fingers crossed. Now, this is an especially dangerous show to do because it's always... Usually, I use this as an excuse to just hear people talk about three games that they like and that are important to them. And it's quite interesting to hear about some games I've maybe not heard of before. But with miniatures and miniature games, I know you may not have necessarily picked three miniature games.
Mm.
But if I talk about miniatures for the length of a podcast, I'm either going to leave this podcast and buy a load of miniatures or design a miniatures game. Because I was thinking about this before, and somehow I designed primarily RPGs, but I've sort of dipped into miniature games, and I think miniature games are more fun to design. They're the most fun game to design, is my theory, because I think they give you an excuse to get all your toys out on the table.
Oh yes,
yeah. Even if you're just on your own and you're doing like initial tests, so I think it taps into that bedroom floor mentality.
I completely agree, and that's always how I start my designs. Like once I've got the whisper of an idea, I will get my toys out and I'll spread them about and I'll start moving them about and get a feel for what might be cool. Because yeah, I completely agree. It like cuts back to being six and imaginatively playing.
So if I leave this podcast and buy a load of stuff I don't need, I can blame you for it.
Oh yeah, no, I've definitely got a couple of ideas about where I might send you scampering to.
There's one that's extremely dangerous, and we'll talk about that when we get to it. So I think we'll go through them in an order of your choosing. But yeah, let's move on to your choices. Okay, Mike. So what have you chosen for your first game that's important to you?
Well, there was a bit of a problem here because I think you and I share something deep in our gaming DNA, which has already been talked about at length on this podcast. And so I cannot choose HeroQuest,
yes.
Which my original set that is daubed with Humbrol paints still sits behind me on a shelf. And the new version from Hasbro, now daubed with my daughter's attempts at acrylic painting, is also behind me because we've been playing that.
Nice.
So instead, I will choose another early, I guess, the miniature game that sort of haunts my earliest dreams and then inspired a bunch of early game design experiments when I was a kid. And I think it is a game that haunts my imagination because I never had it and we only played it a few times, and so my experience of it is through the couple of like hallowed times that I actually got to play it and a bunch of articles and stuff in White Dwarf where we learned much more about it, and that is Manowar.
Wow, this is the one that I was saying was dangerous because I think I will let you explain yourself, this is your show rather than mine, but I will confess that as soon as I saw Manowar, I had a very similar flash where when I came into tabletop gaming, Manowar, I think a matter of months earlier, Manowar had been like discontinued and kind of like stripped from the shelves. I don't recall ever seeing it on the shelf, but I would occasionally get hold of like a slightly older White Dwarf or an older Citadel catalog. And it would be this game that was like hidden away there, like this artifact from the past. And yeah, I, much like yourself, I never got to actually play it, but I had to try and sort of glean what the game was from these old articles and like the big two-page spread that shows like all the box contents, having to sort of pore over that and see if I could decode it. So I'm very excited to hear about how it actually played for you.
I think that is almost the strongest form of nostalgia, is the nostalgia for something you just missed. So piecing it together and decoding it from White Dwarf articles is exactly it. Like, I didn't have a set of it, but having played it and obviously seen it in action once or twice, then you would get these additional ship cards and so forth. And so I guess let's begin. People listening probably know that Manowar.
Yeah, some people may not know what Manowar is to the extent that we do.
Yeah, Manowar was a naval battle miniatures game that was set in the Warhammer world that had all of the Warhammer races represented as teeny tiny little sail ships. And the little ships had little masts, and onto the masts you stuck little paper sails. So it was a bit like the sort of old Hammer paper banners world, but like every ship had like four of them and you had to, you know, cut them out or paint them yourself or whatever. And for me at the time, it was a really intriguing game. I liked the scale of the models, you know, epic tanks and Manowar ships I find just incredibly cute and delightful, and they spark my imagination irresistibly. And the game itself, I have since played it quite recently and found it to be actually extremely lovely, and there's lots of good things that I could say about that game. But one of the things that's true about it is that it's got these ship templates. You get a card for each ship and it's got a picture, a silhouette of the ship, and it's broken up into these segments. And when you shoot a cannon at another ship, you roll a dice, and if the dice result matches one of the little sections on the other person's ship card, then you hit. And so in lots of cases, there isn't a segment for one or two or sometimes three. And it's also got a clever way of, you can shoot high or shoot low if you want to take out their sails to slow them down, or if you want to shoot them in the body to knock them out. And it has a funny little boarding system where you've got little counters on all of your ship templates, and when you bash into each other, you can sort of exchange counters and roll dice and have boarding actions, and it's totally lovely. I also, at the same time, I had a copy of a curious old Games Workshop game called Space Fleet, and so I had some plastic spaceships, and I didn't have any Manowar ships. And what I did have was a computer and a will to learn how to use Microsoft Publisher. And so in Microsoft Publisher, I made all these little templates where I drew pictures of spaceships out of boxes and named the boxes things like engine room, bridge, landing bay and stuff, and gave them all saving throws, and invented my own sort of Space Fleet meets Manowar hybrid, which we played a bit, and I still have all of the ship cards from. And I guess that's probably the earliest like sustained bit of original game design that I did. Obviously, it didn't have an original name. It was called Space Fleet, and it was borrowing a lot of mechanics from Manowar, but it had a really elaborate crew system where you didn't just have crew on your ship, you also put them in a specific location, because there was like a Cards and Counters war game that was in a White Dwarf of the era. The game was called Warmaster, but yes, not the one you're thinking of.
Funnily enough, I've seen this Warmaster thing like within the last couple of months. I saw like a video of someone playing through it, and
nice.
Yeah, it's true. There was, I mean, again, it makes me feel so, it feels so familiar to my own experience, this idea of piecing together a game out of the bits of game that you had, like, and like having an idea of how the game works. And I've given up on not sounding like an old man now, because every podcast we have, I talk about like the pre-internet days and all this stuff. And yeah, the fact is that those White Dwarf magazines and Citadel catalogs and like handed down incomplete games that you had, there was a lot of fun in piecing those together. And I think it is probably objectively better now that you can just go and download a rulebook PDF for pretty much anything and play it with an ease. But it's there was some magic in having to, like you say, having to cobble together a game out of the bits that you had.
And I guess we now know that constraints breed design, and so it kind of makes sense. But I think it was also that the way that I don't know, the way that it was presented kind of left lots. It was both aspirational in that it always had nice terrain and nicely painted ships and stuff, but it also left lots, both lots to the imagination. And I think, you know, there was a lot of, you know, because White Dwarf always had extra rules and stuff in. And I've now since been informed by a friend of mine that I used to get the Citadel Journal, which had lots of other, even slightly more ramshackle rules. I think there was also a lot of, I'm not saying it's different to now, but I'm saying like there was a lot of, showing Games Workshop showing you that you could make up rules and that extra rules were welcome and you could do what you liked. And so I guess I sort of took that it to heart and was like, yeah, great. Okay. Let's make lots of stuff.
And sort of the weird side effect of the, I mean, Games Workshop has a pretty strong monopoly on miniature games right now, but I feel like in the sort of the mid 90s, early 90s, when I was getting into games, it felt like I really wasn't even aware that other war games existed. Like as a child, I was like, well, this is Warhammer, this is the entire genre, because that's the shop that sells Warhammer stuff.
Yeah. And I think that that's, you know, that's potentially quite a British perspective, because I remember getting the opportunity to go on a family holiday to New York because we had some family nearby. And I went to a games shop, and some of my like holiest RPG artifacts like were retrieved from that sally into a New York game store. But one of the things I came back with was a box set of BattleTech, so sort of 95, 96, that kind of around that time. And so I played a bit of BattleTech, which was like, you know, no one had seen such a thing.
But yeah, it's weird because it's, you know, in many ways it was kind of a bad thing that as a child I didn't know these other games existed. But it also meant that the things that I would cobble together, for all I knew, I was like the second best war game designer in the world.
Hell yeah.
Because there was Games Workshop doing it, and I was the first person because like
first person to imagine doing it as well.
Yeah, I was there was another game? And there was a certain freeingness to that, you know, combined with being a child and thinking that everything you do is, you know, you're the first person to think of this. Yeah, it was an interesting time.
What's fun, and this is a total tangent, but because I've been working on a textbook with my co-collaborator, co-conspirator on the Rule of Carnage podcast, which is a podcast we do about miniature games design. Because we've been working on a textbook together, I've been doing a bunch of research into various aspects of wargaming and miniature gaming. And what's really fun is discovering, you know, before the stuff that was inspiring the old guard of Games Workshop and long before we were toddling about with our miniatures. In the 60s and in the 70s, there are these lovely books that you can still get hold of from people like Charles Grant and Donald Featherston, who like wrote about what was going on in wargaming at the time. And there's a particular bit from a Paul Dunn book on naval wargaming where he sort of basically says, look, I'm going to show you some rules for my naval that I use in my house for naval wargaming, which you can incorporate into your rules in your home. Because everyone in these early stages, before there was really anything resembling published rule sets, everyone had their own rules. Like there was no house rules. Every rule set was a house rule set. It was just like, what did we play in, you know, what had I invented based on the inspirations I've got? So I think that what we were doing, you know, when you were taking HeroQuest and sort of feeling your way through to what HeroQuest might be like, and when I was taking Man of War and spaceships and sort of feeling my way through to what a spaceship game was, it's actually like that's exactly what people were doing 20, 40 years before, where no published rule sets existed and everyone was just sort of glomming together bits and scraps that they'd heard and been shown from other fans and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and it's interesting getting the perspective, because when I speak to people who got into gaming a bit before me, sort of in the 80s, let's say, it's that they still have that kind of attitude. And, you know, they knew White Dwarf when it was just a magazine that covered all sorts of different games. Because I came in sort of in the era when White Dwarf was just basically an advertisement. It was a very enjoyable magazine. I loved it. But it was just purely advertising, basically, for their own games. it is interesting that you've got that pre era where people did know about all these different games, and then I'm assuming a lot about when you came in, but I think we're of a similar age. Came in around the sort of
I received Warhammer 40,000 second edition box set for one Christmas. That was the entry point for me.
Which Christmas was this? We need to narrow it down.
I think I was 11, so that would have been 93. So that's my first.
Okay, slightly before me then. So maybe this is why you got the Manowar experience. We should probably get back to Manowar, but I don't know. I feel like what we've actually discussed is the whole phenomenon around what Manowar represents in that part of your life, perhaps.
Yeah. I mean, if we want to talk a little bit about Manowar, like, there are some things that Manowar does which just leaked out into my other games. So when I wanted to make a car combat game where there was inertia and, you know, people were moving around shooting each other, I just reached for some Manowar mechanics almost instinctually. And so the way that shooting works in Gaslands is you put a little short sort of straight template down, and if anything lies under the template, it gets hit, which is just nicked from Manowar. That's just how shooting works in Manowar. And when I started work on A Billion Suns, which is my spaceship game, I returned to the idea of silhouettes and numbered locations, and the first version of that game had basically Manowar ship cards like I'd done in Space Fleet. But through playtesting and development, I kind of realized that if I took because I wanted more locations than Manowar ships had. If I took a Star Destroyer and put 10 different squares on it, I'm like, okay, well now I probably need a D10 or a D12 to arbitrate between these squares. And then I noticed the relationship of if I take a larger dice, it's going to be less likely to hit a small ship, like a two location fighter. And that's cool. That feels like a lumbering laser can't hit a nimble fighter, but if it does, it's absolutely destroyed. And so the dice, like the combat resolution system from A Billion Suns, doesn't look like it, but it is very much just rooted in the Man of War kind of system. It just ended up getting mutated and sort of developed on its way to its final form. So yeah, there's a ton in that game that, I don't know, just sort of inescapably shapes the way that I approach miniature games. And it's quite an odd game. Like, it doesn't really have a lot of roots in other Games Workshop games, and it doesn't really reflect later Games Workshop games in any meaningful way.
Like, even the factions, it's kind of, it's not always immediately, like, if you're playing, I guess a good comparison would be like something like Epic. Like, if you look at an epic army, you can usually tell who it is based on, like, if you know the 40K factions.
Mm.
But yeah, Manowar feels distinct. Like, you can usually work it out, but it's not so immediately obvious, like, oh, these are this is the Dark Elf fleet or whatever. It is literally happening in a different theater, I suppose, is the point.
Yeah, right.
So it's like you get to see a different side of things, which I guess they then, I guess, Battlefleet Gothic would be the sort of the other side of that coin. Did you ever get to play that one?
No, that came out just at the tail end of my sort of teenage gaming period. Mm. So I'd sort of mostly left miniatures games by the time Battlefleet Gothic came out in 99, and I was like solidly playing both tabletop role-playing games but also quite a lot of live vampire at that point. So I didn't play that era of things. I missed I missed Mordheim and I missed Battlefleet Gothic.
Again, that it feels, it's exciting to see a kind of different side of the setting, I guess, that you don't normally get to see. And but simultaneously, I guess the difficulty there is, I think from a business perspective, I imagine it was quite a tough sell.
Well, I mean, not only is it a completely different scale, completely different kinds of models, they're also quite small forces. So it's basically a skirmish game. Like, you tend to have like one or two independent ships and, you know, maybe two or three squadrons of three ships, which is like a really cool looking small force, and it feels really good, and it's got a little bit of unit movement, a little bit of independent movement, and so that's cool. And listen, like, if you want to be tempted and dip your toes into the Man of War waters, it's actually really easy to do so. So you can acquire the rules as PDFs from the internet for sure, but most importantly, you can get a really lovely set of rule summaries and like better ship cards that fit inside like poker card sized card sleeves from from the Esoteric Order of Gamer. Like, he built a full set of like sort of new ship cards for it, which is how I used to play.
Oh, wow.
And you don't have to necessarily go and look on eBay for old metal miniatures, although a surprising number are still kind of liquidly being traded. If you go to Etsy, there are a wonderful selection of 3D printed ships that are appropriate for most of the factions. So a lot of the ships that I've been using over the last couple of years have been those kind of 3D printed ones. And it's, yeah, it's just a really fun game, and you don't need very much to get involved, and it is just an enjoyable time.
Well, I'm going to fight the urge, but I can feel the pull, definitely. Or the push of wind, I guess, is the to use a thematic approach.
The foul stench of the winds of chaos.
That's it, blowing me towards bankruptcy, yeah. So I think...
Let's move on quick, lads.
Yeah, let's do it. Let's move on. So, your second choice of game, what have you gone for?
So I just mentioned my teenage gaming era. So it's a tale oft told. But you know, when I got to university, I put aside childish things and indulged in making music and getting drunk and attempting to attract the opposite sex. Having achieved all of those things, when I moved into a house with my now wife in London. In about 2010, 2012, we started picking up board games and getting into tabletop gaming again. And so my kind of departure, my decade of decadence departure from the hobby ended. And quite shortly after getting back into board games, I started painting miniatures because I had this thing where I'd never really finished an army as a kid, because who finishes an army as a kid? Come on, people. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to finish an army. So I bought a 6mm goblin army, because that's cheating. So I finished a 6mm goblin army, and I thought, oh, I could play Warmaster or something with this, remembering some old games. Because I had to buy some paints, I sort of had to break the seal and walk into a Games Workshop for the first time in 10 years. Because I couldn't find a board game club, I ended up asking around and finding a Warhammer or a Wargaming club here in Canterbury. And the first time I walked into that club, I think carrying some 40k Tyranids that I was going to maybe try and find a game with. The sort of entranceway hall had a bunch of square tables, small square tables. They were 3-foot square tables, which I hadn't really seen before, set up with some incredibly exciting looking miniatures that I had never seen before. And I picked up a couple of them, and one of them was a teddy bear with fangs and blood dripping from its mouth. And the other was a guy dressed in a like morning jacket, like a tail suit, and he had tentacle face, and he was holding an eyeball that he had just plucked from someone. And I was like, what is this? I want to play this game. So I sat and I watched them play some Malifaux first edition for a while instead of going and playing some Warhammer, and I was immediately besotted with the aesthetic of the game. And I was immediately intrigued by the gameplay of the game, because they were flipping cards out and they weren't rolling dice, and there was a small table and there was not very many models. And, you know, it reminded me of my love of Necromunda, but it had all these intriguing rules ideas. So I immediately went and picked up a copy of that game, played a lot of the first edition, got involved a bit in the early access for the second edition, played a lot of second edition. And in fact, for the first time in my life, played competitive war games, because there was a really lovely... smallish but very active tournament circuit. There probably still is, but sort of 2014-15, I was really involved in the Malifaux tournament circuit and got to know a lot of lovely people from across the UK, and just sort of fell in love with this miniature skirmish game, which sort of blew my mind from a rules design perspective. And a lot of the ideas that Malifaux have leaked into my own games, but I think that the most sort of delightful and of an obvious part of it is their dispensing with dice and their use of cards. And the reason I think that's cool is because they give you a hand of cards that you can then use to control the action, and so you get a hand of cards that you can use to swap in if you flip out a card result that you don't like. And so you've got in front of you a piece of information about how good your turn is going to be, or a sort of set of options about you can make two or three things that really matter probably work. When are you going to choose to do those? Mm-hmm. And are you going to give into the temptation of, you know, there's a model that maybe doesn't matter that much in the tactical situation, but, you know, you're getting smashed by someone's attack and you really don't want, and, you know, or you've got an opportunity to take a model out and, you know, this could be the moment that you use the big card, but it's not really the thing that's going to win you the game. And that, I think, leads to the second thing that I was totally delighted by initially, which was, you know, you can get completely destroyed and still win the game, because the game is not about killing models. The game is about completing objectives. And that seems kind of obvious, but it's often not as extremely stated in many miniature games, where honestly, killing models doesn't win you anything. It just, you know, as long as you've popped down, you know, the scheme markers, or you've delivered the message to the enemy master, or, you know, and I guess the other part of it was that those objectives were all framed in these non-combat terms, where it wasn't that, like, the purpose of your crew's activities was not always, it was occasionally, but it was not always to go and murder as many people as possible. It was, you know, you needed to plant some evidence to frame the opposing leader so that they would get arrested by the guild forces, or you need to, like, slip them a note because your, like, higher up wants to have a secret meeting with them. And so there was all this intrigue and sort of story that was built into the way that the game was supposed to unfold on the table. And in the first edition rulebook, they really lent into that, and there was loads of tables for generating different locations, and were you in a railway station or a library, or, you know, or a theater, and it just, it was so narratively rich and also so suggestive of, like, well, we might be having a fight, but it's because of some things that are relevant to our, like, character and the machinations that we're trying to get done as a force in this universe. And to be honest with you, I think a lot of that stuff ended up not 100% getting realized in the gameplay, or not 100% getting kind of built on top of, and maybe second edition took some of that away. But at its heart, I found that so refreshing. And, you know, it might be because I didn't, you know, I, like I said, I missed out on more time, and I had kind of, you know, my experience of narrative gaming was in Necromunda, and we played a lot. You know, I even played, like, we played a Necromunda RPG, tabletop RPG, that was like a drift of the Warhammer fantasy roleplay system, but set in Necromunda. So we did take Necromunda seriously as a narrative concern, but it didn't, within the game, it had these little things where, like, if someone gets knocked down, they get stolen by a Gan Maimra, then you have to do the mission to, like, free them. But Malifaux pushed it further and wrapped it in all the wording of the objectives was all really non-combat and stuff. Yeah, so I just found the whole thing totally inspirational, and it really pushed my imagination for what skirmish games and just miniature games in general could be. And I've kind of never recovered from that. Like, I'm still seeking some of the highs and some of the ideas that that the guys behind Malifaux sort of proposed and then tried solutions for, and maybe they worked and maybe they didn't quite work. And so I almost want to continue the great work that they did in a lot of my designs. And you can see a lot of it in, like, the mission design system of A Billion Suns is
definitely
rich with stolen sort of ideas from Malifaux. And let me pause on that rant, because honestly, I could go on for days about Malifaux.
Well, I'm glad that you can, because I'm familiar with Malifaux, and I've read the rule book at some point, and I've looked at it sort of as an outsider. But I think the thing that really stuck out with what you said there is that the kind of the standard scenario isn't just a pitched battle. Because what I've noticed is whenever I learn, like, a new RPG, so thinking back over the last few years, I've played sort of the most recent edition of 40K. I played that with some friends who had that box set. And I've got into Battletech in the last few years as well. Mm-hmm. And lots of other games that I've picked up. For the first game, because we're trying to make it simple, we'll often say, oh, well, let's just play a really simple scenario, pitch battle, and we'll just try and kill each other.
Yeah.
But even though that on paper sounds very simple, and you think, well, I don't want to complicate things with a complicated scenario before we actually know the rules, I really like that they put that at the forefront. So you're straight away, you're going into those more unusual scenarios, even if they're still simple, that's, they feel very different to a, like you say, just a let's see who can murder each other the most. Because what happens is, I found after we do these very simple pitched battles as a kind of learning game, the thing we always say, me and my friend, is like, oh yeah, that was fine, but next time let's do a scenario. Like, let's do something more interesting. And then what happens is we don't see each other for a couple of months, and then we get the game out and we say, no, let's keep it simple. And it almost feels too daunting sometimes to do a wilder scenario if it's a new system.
I completely agree. And I think one of the risks that they took with Malifaux is that they baked into the game, like, the section on setting up a game doesn't let you do that.
Yeah, exactly.
It basically says, okay, first you have to flip to find out what the environment is. Now you have to flip to find out, like, what the main objective is. And then you have to flip to find out what the sub objectives are, and you have to select from them. And it just doesn't, provide a scenario that's like a straight up battle. And so you can't, like, it just doesn't give you the way to sort of undermine what it's selling you.
Yeah.
And I agree. Like, it's fun because it drags you into the, what they consider to be the good bits of the game, sort of kicking and screaming. And you have to crack on and deal with that. And it is a risk. And I took that risk in A Billion Suns, and I don't know if it paid off because it's, you know, it's complicated, and there's lots of, you know, you ask a lot from players when you do that.
And I feel bad because I feel like I'm part of the problem, because we met very briefly at UK Games Expo. And I think I said to you the exact thing that now I look back and cringe, which is like, oh yeah, Billion Suns, I've got it. It sounds amazing. But I don't know. I feel like I wish I could just play a pitch battle with it or something. And that's it's just like an instinct. Even though I disagree with it, I don't think it's the right attitude. I think the right way to play Billion Suns isn't to sort of squeeze it into being like another Battlefleet Gothic or whatever. I think Billion Suns is the thing that it is, and that's what makes it, you know, really
exciting. And I think, like, I'm currently talking to Offspray about what a second edition of that game would look like, and honestly, like, I would like Billion Suns to be a bit more of a general purpose toolkit.
Nah, three tables minimum.
Well, the first version of A Billion Suns, I'm really proud of, but it is a really bizarre prog album of a game that, like, it does what it does, and it does it, like, uncompromisingly. But that uncompromisability is sort of what makes it hard to get people in. And if they could play a pitched battle where they go, ooh, the combat system is really elegant, and I like the way that, like, the order mechanic works, and I like these commands tokens, what else can we do with the game? And then I'm like, well, let me introduce you to the second Dan of this game, which is the, you know, procedurally generated story mode. But, you know, I'm happy with the decisions I made, because A Billion Suns is a weird game that has a sort of, it was successful because it's weird. If it had just been like another Battlefleet Gothic, it wouldn't have been its own thing. But exactly. Maybe a second edition is allowed to be both of those things in a way that the first edition wasn't. Mm. And I think that Malifaux has nudged itself over time in a direction where it left some of the richness of the procedurals, like, ultimately asking people to flip to find out what table, like what location, whether it's a library or a dock, like, that doesn't really make sense, because you're not going to have 12 tables worth of thematic terrain just behind you on a shelf ready to go. So some of those things are kind of aspirational, but to a degree it doesn't really matter, because you put that stuff in the game and it says to hobbyists, hey, if you wanted to make a library, you should do that, because here it is on the random table, which you're allowed to ignore or choose from. And so I love that, and I still think people should put that in. And, you know, when I'm thinking about one of my games that is yet to be published, which is Perilous Tales, like, that very much is supposed to be a sort of pulp movie, horror movie emulator, and I'm going to definitely put a table, like a table of, here's how to randomly select where in the universe you are playing, not because I expect people to do it, but because I find it useful as an imagination and hobby trigger.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of sort of putting those things in there as the way to, like, slip in the setting, if you like. So, yeah.
100%. I mean, it's like in your game, The Doomed, like, you're not expecting people to have all 36.
Yeah. No one's making, well, maybe it's someone, if someone does it, they can be the first to do it. Maybe that's the aspiration, but yeah, I'm not expecting people to have them all on hand.
Right. But you're doing the same as what the Malifaux terrain table does, which is you're creating this imaginative space. You're pulling it open and saying, look, here's the breadth of what is going to be going on the table. So, it's an invitation to you to take what you want from that set of inspirations and cook up your own delicious table setup.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, again, like, another weird example is the sort of the weird time that I got into, like, 40K and Warhammer. There were a lot of units in like the army lists that didn't have models anymore. It would either be the case that they previously had models that had been like delisted. So the one that always comes to mind is, I remember in the, in fact, I think we were saying the second edition, I think it was the second edition 40K box came with a like basic army lists for a load of factions. And it had in there, it had Gene Stealer Cults and Adeptus Mechanicus, which from my knowledge of looking in the Games Workshop shops and looking through the catalogs, I was like, there's no miniatures for these, because I think they, there had been some that had been sort of discontinued and the new range hadn't come out yet. But I still remember reading through those lists, and that was a way of kind of exploring the galaxy of this, this world. Like, I'm learning about this faction because I'm reading through the armor list. Whereas if they'd included a big block of prose about, well, who is the Adeptus Mechanicus? My low attention span 11-year-old self might not have read that, but because it was in the format of an army list, it kind of like it drew me in. So yeah, I like that as ways to kind of like get people to read about the setting without necessarily realizing they're doing it.
So returning very briefly to this idea that like at its heart, Malifaux first edition particularly promised this like procedural story generator where the things that you did on the table were going to like not be about just punching each other to a bloody pulp, but they were going to be about like what your forces were up to and what kind of stories and narratives were coming out. That maybe leads on to my sort of final selection, which is the first time that I really saw a story engine kind of working in a way that from a games designer's perspective, I was like, oh wow, there is a lot to learn from here.
What was your third choice?
So my third choice is Arkham Horror, the card game. So not a miniatures game, not a role-playing game. But for me, it sort of sits in this really interesting place between all of the forms of gaming.
And not the board game as well, should we clarify?
We should clarify.
Living card game, is that right?
I hate Arkham Horror, the board game.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that. Because, yeah, I'm going to let you talk, but I have a horror story about that game.
Well, I mean, yeah.
Not a good horror story.
The theme of this next section will be like how to make exciting narratives happen in a credible way. And Arkham Horror is just like, flip a card. You left the gas on. Lose two sanity. It's like,
and you know what? I could respect that in a way, like a completely arbitrary, silly game.
So arbitrary.
But it was. Anyway, we'll come back to this. Let's talk about the good one.
So let me. So the other thing, another thing that you probably remember from the 90s as well is that CCGs were a big deal in the 90s.
Yeah,
there was a lot of collectible card games that came out with all kinds of different themes because any big TV show or movie franchise, at some point somebody would be like, we should make a collectible card game for this. So, you know, there are very obvious examples like the X-Files collectible card game, which I didn't own, but a friend of mine had a bunch of packs of and we've played in the last couple of years. There's my sort of favorite indie darling role-playing game, On the Edge. It had a CCG called Over the Edge, which I still have boxes of, and the artwork is really psychedelic and inspirational. It would be right off your street, Chris, if you haven't seen those cards.
I know the role-playing game, but yeah, I didn't realize there was a CCG as well.
Yeah, it's the artwork is so wacky. It's quite electric Bastion Land adjacent in its in its vibe.
I mean, I'll be honest, I know this is interrupting, I'm sorry, but I want to clarify because I know this is very rude of me. If you heard my keyboard clacking then, it's because I was opening a browser and typing X-Files CCG into eBay. not to do now, but to remind myself to take a little look afterwards because that sounds up my street as well. I didn't realize that was a thing.
Yeah, that's... So one of the CCGs that I had a bunch of packs of and then lost and then repurchased later on in life was something called Mythos. And the Mythos card game was a Lovecraftian game where you had an investigator and there were monsters that could pop out of a deck and you had to move between locations. And so you got these, you know, you randomly got in different packs like, you know, Arkham locations and Lovecraft country locations and outer space locations and, you know, Egyptian things. And some of them were deep in the depths of time and some of them were, you know, were in the 20s and whatnot. And it almost delivered on the idea of creating a kind of Call of Cthulhu scenario sort of card game situation where you almost had the sense that there was a coherent plot, and you almost had the sense that you were moving between locations as a sort of investigative party and solving mysteries and stuff. Because there were these things called, what were they called? Investigation cards. And they were like, they had a little story on them, and some of the words in the story were highlighted, and those were matched to card names. And so you sort of hit the different cards as you found them in your deck, then you had successfully told a story. Anyway, it didn't really work, and it didn't really do what I was hoping it would do, which is essentially a Call of Cthulhu card game. Because I played a lot of Call of Cthulhu growing up, and I'm still obsessed with investigative gaming. I play a lot of Trail of Cthulhu, and I recently discovered Cthulhu Dark, which is really nice.
I'm a big fan.
Yeah, which I did a little hack of, a little drift of for my most recent. Anyway, Arkham Horror, the card game, has a couple of extremely nice innovations in it. At its heart, it's a deck building sort of CCG type of a thing where you can spend infinite amounts of money on Fantasy Flight cardboard, and they will give you an increasing range of cards with which to build a deck, like a 30 card deck for your investigator. And then the second half of the product line is a set of like adventure modules where you get a bunch of monsters, but critically you get these little mini decks which sit in the middle of the table, and they're called the agenda deck and the act deck. And that is where like the magic of Arkham Horror comes, which is that you've got two little mini decks, one of which is the game running on a clock. And each time it hits one of the thresholds on the clock, it flips the agenda deck over and it does something unpleasant to you. It reconfigures the board, it summons a monster, it, you know, takes some of your resources away, it does something unpleasant. And it has a lovely bit of flavor text which explains what is going on and why this mechanic is happening. And then the other mini deck is the act deck. And that is the thing that you as the investigators are trying to progress. And so by collecting clue tokens, by investigating locations, you collect enough resources to advance, you know, hit the threshold and advance the act. And that's a sort of the opposite. It's like a positive effect. It's like, oh, okay, you discover the next layer of the investigative onion, or you know. And so that is a wonderful mechanic. And I'm still trying to figure out how to make something like that work in a miniatures game where it integrates into the tabletop experience, because it's this lovely combination of sort of pre-written, pre-delivered story in a way that feels really tightly integrated with the gameplay. And it is kind of like a single player story mode in a video game, which you don't really see a lot successfully implemented with enough narrative to like bring it to life. But they've managed to do it by condensing a lot of the narrative into like the little setup manual that you read, the sort of preamble, and then the cards themselves, you know, the game and you are revealing text as you go through. So the first playthrough of a scenario is like, it's really exciting and you don't know what's going to happen. And particularly you tend to not see all of the different flavor text because you know, you maybe ace the scenario and don't get to the bottom of the agenda deck, or you get absolutely trashed and you never see what the win condition was.
I mean, the thing that leaps to mind is, as far as I'm aware, something I'm amazed has never been made. I guess that the two big like tabletop game forces in my childhood were, you know, the miniatures stuff of like Warhammer and all that side of things, but also like game books, like fighting fantasy books.
Yeah,
so 100%. I'm amazed there's never been like an official, like, well, let's face it, Games Workshop in the 90s, an official Games Workshop like style fighting fantasy book that needed miniatures and you needed a giant board with a load of miniatures to play.
But yeah, that's a good job. They did a bit, they experimented a bit with that in the Warhammer Quest range. They certainly did it in Silver Tower. I can't remember. The other thing that I really like about it is that it's got a really fail forward design, where unlike something like Kingdom Death Monster, which is like a miniatures based board game where, you know, it's supposed to be really hard and there's similar kind of choose your own adventure narrative stuff that you can read out, that game's quite brutal, where like if you fail you probably all died and you sort of have to restart, a bit like a Dark Souls video game. But with Arkham Horror the card game, it's different. Like whether or not you win the scenario is somewhat relative, and even if you absolutely like fluff it up and you all get knocked out and, you know, you basically don't get to the anywhere near the end of the scenario, the game still carries you forward to the next scenario. It's just that it gives you some inscrutable possible punishment for it, which is normally phrased in like, you know,
oh, the Academy knows that you're coming. Write that down on your character sheet. And you're like, how is this going to come out? Like, you don't even get a mechanical sense of what the Academy knows you are coming is even going to do. And so it's really exciting. And it provides this, like, this sort of mystery and this plot hook where it's like, I'm pretty sure this is going to come and bite me at some later point, but it doesn't matter. Let's carry on with the story and let's play the next mission. And it's like the game kind of carries you through the content. And because of that, you also, I find it's quite replayable where you're like, I didn't get what felt like the optimum sort of win in inverted commas situation from this. I kind of want to play it again and find out what happens if I, you know, do successfully sneak in without the Academy noticing me or whatever it is.
Sure. Yeah, that sounds it's really cool.
Like, more things should do that where they're just like, instead of you fail, try again. More things should just, you know, take that idea from that's so rich in role-playing and just be like, yeah, failure is amazing. Let's use it for story.
Yeah. And even just like really plainly stating it, like, I mean, I forget the name of the games now. The video games where you're playing through a thing and it will say, you'll make a decision and it will come up on screen and it will say, oh, such and such will remember this. I can't remember which game this is, but it's like a sort of narrative game that you kind of work through a story. And even just highlighting it like that, and because we're so used to characters in games not remembering stuff that we've done, and we don't always expect that to happen. I think it's great to foreshadow it and sort of literally making you write that down. I think is really powerful rather than just sort of behind the scenes changing things. I think that's really cool.
Yeah. So I really like that. And I think about it a lot, and I want to make sure that as I think more about the sort of story side games of that I've got sort of lined up and planning, that's very much an important consideration for me.
So I've looked at this game multiple times and I've picked up the box and looked at it and I thought, this sounds really cool. And I've read reviews and they've said, oh yeah, this is great, you should get it. And my partner and I, we love cooperative games. Mm. It seems like a perfect fit. But I think, like we said at the start, I've got Arkham Horror issues from the past. because Arkham Horror was the second ever game that I picked up with my partner when we sort of got into designer board games, I guess. And we tried Pandemic first, was our first game. And we tried it and we were like, this is incredible. Because obviously, you know, it's easy to forget now because it's been around so much, but it's a classic and it's so accessible and it's so clever in a very accessible way. Mm-hmm. So we went back to the board game shop and we said, we loved Pandemic. What would you recommend? And the very kind person in the shop suggested Arkham Horror and said, oh, this is a bit more complex, but it's the same thing. You know, it's cooperative. You're going around trying to sort of manage all these problems and it's really difficult and it's like a good puzzle. And we were like, yeah, we're ready for a slightly more complicated Pandemic. And yeah, it wasn't. It was a learning it, and it was just a struggle. And I'm glad that there is now a way to play this idea of the game of, you know, being investigators and cooperative. I love that there's a way to do that now that works, but it still lingers in my memory, the experience of trying to learn that game and trying to play it, because it was rough.
Yeah, I mean, Arkham Horror the board game for me is just, it's emblematic of what a story generator isn't. And what that game does is just have like a load of really vague, unhelpful sort of seeds for ideas. And no logical way that they get strung together. So it's just like people shouting like random lines of a movie at you. And it doesn't make any coherent sense. Like, it's just complete garbage. And so for me, it becomes like this really tedious and overlong and over token heavy sort of administrative job where we just have to do our taxes with a Cthulhu theme for like 6 hours. And the more players you add, just the more tedious it gets. And I remember it was like very similar. Like, we'd gotten back into board games and somebody had a copy and they brought it round and we had like some friends who from out of town and we played a 6-person game of it. And the problem with a 6-person game of Arkham Horror is it takes about 3 weeks. But also, the game is so poorly designed that like there's nothing for the third, fourth and fifth players to do because all of the like stuff that the game has vomited onto the board has already been dealt with. And it's just the most miserable and shite experience I've ever had. Anyway, the good news is that there's absolutely nothing that connects Arkham Horror, the board game, and Arkham Horror, the card game, other than the artwork. There's just nothing. They're just not even, they don't resemble each other in any way. Now, caveat, I haven't played the most recent iteration of Arkham Horror. I have played the one where they put it on a world map and called it something else.
Eldritch Horror?
Yeah.
Yeah, I heard that was better.
it's better, but it has all the same like story doesn't work garbage that annoys me as a player that's looking for a Lovecraftian narrative. And like Arkham Horror, the card game, doesn't do Lovecraftian narratives. It does like pulp adventure. It does Indiana Jones narratives with Cthulhu monsters, which is, you know, how about half of my Call of Cthulhu campaigns go anyway. So that's fine. But I can't recommend getting into it because, like, you might need that £1,000 for something else.
True. Well, you know what? Just as a small segue on the spectrum of the spectrum that has Arkham Horror the card game at one end of like fantastic, and has Arkham Horror the board game at the other end in the depths of hell. Where would you place the X-Files CCG from the 90s? Because I need to decide whether or not I'm buying this box anyway.
Okay. Let me see. Because
I won't hold you to this if we're casting your mind back 20 years here.
No. We played it about 2 years ago. And
okay.
I think we played it correctly. I think it just about works. I wanted immediately to house rule a couple of things, but not very major. If you go on Board Game Geek, you'll actually find a little quick reference card that I created for it a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. When I was playing it. I think it's sort of lurking in the middle. It functions like it has a sort of. The thing is, it's not cooperative. It's head to head. Which this might turn you off it because it's not what you're imagining. Maybe in your mind, like I'm trying to get the resources to finish my investigation, whilst you are trying to like. You're basically playing your investigator and the bad guy that I'm investigating, and I'm playing my investigator and the bad guy.
So like Netrunner, but we're both doing both
sort
roles.
Sort of like Netrunner, but you play both ends at the same time. But yeah, I mean, we didn't talk about Netrunner. Netrunner's way over on the Arkham Horror card game side of the spectrum for me as well. But I don't know. Like, it's a curious little beast.
I'll see how cheap these are going.
Well, the thing is, the problem with like trying to collect old CCGs is you might end up with a couple of like fixed card box starter boxes, but never really have enough to assemble an actual game. But meh.
Right, cool. That's another one on my shop. And this is turning into an expensive podcast. So, looking back at your three choices, do you think there's any... What would you say is kind of the connection between these three? Is there anything that you think kind of... that these three all tell us about you?
Look, I hope that... as a games designer, I am a person who is looking for the best examples of things and unabashedly incorporating them into my own designs. Because I think what I'm looking for all the time and why I'm driven to play so many games and read so many games is I'm just really excited by new technology, if I might put it that way. Like the technology of you could call it technology, you could call it alchemy as well, which is like you take these inert written rules and you combine them together in a concoction and somehow some magic happens and you feel feelings and your imagination goes wild on the tabletop. And so I guess with Man of War, with Malifaux, with Arkham Horror, the card game, like they all for me had these new pieces of technology, these new ideas, these new approaches to solving some exciting, you know, they just give you new tools for creating game experiences. And I think that's what connects them all for me and why I'm so excited with the craft of making games, because there's still so much to do. And I think miniature games particularly, they feel very early on in their evolution. Like, although we've been playing them potentially for, you know, 100, 200 years, depending on how you look at it, it's been quite niche and there's not been an enormous amount of sort of effort. There's not a lot of people who've been laboring over them in the same way that, like, when you compare it to the number of people who've been trying to push RPGs forward, or goodness, the number of people who've been trying to push video games forward. Like, there's a lot of space still in that particular design area, and that's why I'm particularly pleased with it.
And I think one of the things that leapt out at me was an interesting kind of, I hate to say contradiction here, which I think could be fun to ask about. When you spoke about Manowar, I think the first thing you mentioned was the small scale ships, which I agree with you. I think there's something magical about like the tiny, tiny scales. I've been dipping into 2mm myself, and I'm now like, how far can we go? There's something charming about the tiny things. And in Malifaux as well, you said that when you walked in, you know, you got drawn in by these miniatures. And before we hit record, you were talking about how your next game is not going to use miniatures.
Yeah.
How important are the miniatures to you when it comes to the I know they're sort of intertwined, but like the craft and the sort of collection of the miniatures versus the sort of the rules and mechanics of the game.
Ultimately, for me, like the cinema that unfolds in front of me is the most important thing. That's the thing that I'm striving for. It's like, how am I evoking the sort of sensations and feelings? And and for me, a lot of it is visual, almost cinematography kind of things. And what you're referring to there is I've got a game coming out from Offspray in a year or so, and it's called Pacific Command, and it's my first historical game. And it grew out of A Billion Suns being a spaceship game, and thinking, oh, I wonder what about this game is applicable to World War II naval combat, because it feels like a lot of games start from naval combat and end up in spaceships. That's literally what Gav Thorpe and Andy Chambers talk about having done with Battlefleet Gothic. I wonder what happens if I go backwards and do it in the opposite way. And then I started getting really excited about the stories that people tell about carrier combat, and how no one knew, they didn't have radar, they didn't know where any of the ships were. The ships could like strike each other from like 300 miles away with aircraft, and like what actually the stories that people tell are told through maps, where those maps have little task forces on, and the location of the task forces in many cases is uncertain, and here's where they thought the task force was. And so for me, taking like a wargaming table and saying, okay, this is a map of an area of the Pacific, and what's interesting is that there are these task forces which may or may not be in these locations. And so I started using poker chips, because pushing poker chips around and bluffing what's inside them is kind of super, you know, works. And I'd been looking at ship miniatures and looking at, for example, Victory at Sea from Warlord Games, and thinking, well, these miniatures are beautiful, but they don't at all resemble the stories that we tell about these vessels. And so for me, I adore miniatures, and my desk here is strewn with miniatures that I'm painting for the demo games for Hobgoblin at Salute in a week's time as we record. But those are the same as the poker chips. They are the way that I get to the cinema that I want to unfold in the table. And if I want the Battle of Helm's Deep to unfold, like, I've got to have a lot of little goblins painted here. And if I want like the stories that we tell about aircraft carrier combat to unfold, then it needs to look like a map. And I suppose that's the consistency there.
Yeah. And like the fog of war itself is kind of the star of the show almost, which I think is 100%. Again, I think it's really fascinating to see it. I think the thing that can sometimes, you spoke about like there being all this space to explore in war game design. And I think that's something that I've not really seen explored as a full thing. But anyway, I'm not going to gush about this game, because I'm going to give you in a minute a chance to tell us where more people can read about it. Thank you for sharing your choices with us. Where can people find out more about your stuff?
So I am currently now full-time creating games under the moniker Planet Smasher Games, which is a little logo that I invented a few years ago with the hope that one day I would be able to quit my job and take it full-time. So you can find me at planetsmashergames.com, or if you go to YouTube, you can search for Planet Smasher Games. And part of what I'm trying to do is share the sort of journey that I'm on, because I'm not planning on making a games company or hiring anyone. I just want to be a maker, and I just want to share kind of my process of what I'm building and making. And I mentioned the Rule of Carnage podcast as well, which you can search for on Podcast Apparatus and on YouTube. And that is also me and my good buddy Glenn sharing our thoughts as we muddle through the various problems and technologies of miniature games design. So yeah, look for me on YouTube and follow along to see what I'm making. And I'm also I'm filled to the brim with game ideas, and so I am spewing them out into prototypes, which I'm releasing via Itch, and you can have a little look through my website at the sort of prototype games that I'm putting out there. Ideas that have emerged from my brain in a playable sort of initial form, which I don't know whether I'll make them into fully fledged games yet. Like, I'm kind of putting them out there to find out if people think they're exciting, which is kind of what I was doing with the Blaster anthology magazine thing. I'm now doing even lower budget on Itch. So yeah, that's that.
And for those who are listening, at the risk of sounding like an advert, I think if you've not played war games or miniature games before, or you've tried out sort of more typical war games before and you weren't always impressed, I would thoroughly recommend checking out Mike's stuff because it is all very different in a fantastic way. So thank you to Mike for joining me, and thank you everyone for listening. As always, you can keep up to date with everything Bastionland at bastionland.com, where there are links to the Discord server, YouTube channels, and to Patreon, where you can help to support this podcast. You can join me next week, where I'll be welcoming another guest to distill their gaming history into the Rule of Three. Goodbye for now.